It's a public service announcement brought to you by the good folks at the Educated Guest Podcast. Your boys RF, Mr. AYYY, and Ed Nunez, the supervisor of sound. And it goes like this. If you ain't ready to vote, then don't say shit come November 6th. Today's educator is also a candidate on the ballot. He is a professor in practice, teaching politics at the University of California, San Diego, one of the finest institutions of these United States. But he is currently also running for County Board of Supervisors, and he goes by the name of Nathan Fletcher. I want you to hear his story, his journey through education, his beliefs in equity, and all the wonderful things that make him an awesome candidate. Come November 6th, if this man is on your ballot, I want you to hear this podcast and I want you to enjoy voting for him. We begin our discussion about his course at UCSD and how he believes in project-based learning. Can't wait for y'all to get into this. Nathan Fletcher on the Educated Guest Podcast. Let's go.
Every one of my classes at UCSD that I teach revolves around a pretty significant project the students do for that class.
All right.
And so I think when you have that, I think I'm a fan of project-based learning. I think, you know, you get a product, and I've had so many of my students who have taken their final project in my class, whether it be the Voting Rights Act class or California Politics and Government, or the campaigns. I teach class How to Win or Lose an Election. I can teach you both. and they've taken their final project and used them in job interviews. You know, they've sat it down and said, hey, that's a campaign plan I wrote. Or, you know, interviewing for a legislative office, hey, that's a legislative plan that I wrote to pass a real bill. You know, Voting Rights Act, you know, they do a project. And they've gotten jobs. People have been like, wow, you know, this is really impressive. So I'm just an overall fan of the project-based learning.
Wow, wow. We did actually interview Mike Strong on this podcast.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, you got to hear it because it's some powerful shit. I mean, he's a really deep and passionate educator.
Yeah.
His ideas, some people will call them revolutionary. He's a big dreamer in the field, but it was an awesome podcast, and we did question him a little about the semester upstream because I'm like, hey, these kids spent like a semester with you, and they weren't in a classroom. Like, what kind of credit did they get for that, right? I mean, because that's important.
Sure.
And then he said that he's credentialed in a couple of areas, as was his partner Brian, credentialed in the other areas. So they basically got 4 credits for working this.
Yeah.
Maybe more. I don't know. But I think it was 4 minimum. And I was just like, dude, that's just a pretty amazing class to even sit down and put together with people. You know what I mean?
Well, and watching, just having, you know, one of our kids who was in that, just the engagement and the interest and, you know, it still comes up to this day. He's talking about, we need this legislation for the Salton Sea or that legislation. And you know, to see how it encompassed every kind of aspect of learning in a kind of structured way around something they had an interest in, but also around something that they'll always remember. I mean, one of the things, I went to the dean at UCSD a few years ago, and I said, I want to add a class. So I teach upper division, undergraduate, but upper division political science courses at UCSD.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have 120 to 140 students a quarter, primarily juniors and seniors, most of them, almost all of them, social science or poli-sci majors. And I said, I want to do an entire class on one piece of legislation, right? I said, I don't want to do a class on Congress. Right, I don't want to do a class on the legislative process. I want to do it on one bill. And I said, because so often in college, if you look back on your college experience, you probably can't even remember what classes you took, much less what you actually learned in that class. You may say, well, I took macroeconomics or microeconomics, or you may remember a professor you liked. But if I asked you, if you were a poli-sci major, and I said, okay, the U.S. Congress, what did you learn in that class? You're like, I don't know. You know, you're not sure.
Let me flip through my notes.
Yeah, exactly. So I said, I want to do an entire class on the Voting Rights Act.
Okay.
Right? What I think is one of the most consequential and significant pieces of legislation in our history. I mean, something that was transformative, that had a dynamic impact. And it wasn't so much of legislation as around the margins. You know, you're making a condition a little better, but you aren't fundamentally changing it. You know, you aren't in some ways solving the problem. You're making it a little bit better. And the Voting Rights Act in so many ways did that. And
it's even under attack.
Well, and that's what makes it so relevant today, right? Was like in our class, we go back to the beginning and we see the tremendous progress. You know, a lot of folks don't realize in the late 1800s in America, there were 22 African-Americans from the South serving in the U.S. Congress. Hmm. Mississippi had a African-American senator.
Okay.
Right. In the 1800s. And so we had seen tremendous progress, and then we saw tremendous setbacks, and all of that was undone. And so then it had to start over at the beginning in the early 1900s, the movement kind of began and cultivated, and there was a lot of shaping public opinion, moving public opinion. There were a lot of little victories, some civil rights acts in the 50s that were, you know, people were voting for something called civil rights. They didn't really do a whole lot. And then it ultimately culminated in the Civil Rights Act of 64 and then the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And after that point is when we really began to see tremendous progress that really culminated in the election of Barack Obama in 2008. Mm. And so, you know, my students learned, we saw all this progress, and then we had this huge setback. And then we saw all of this progress. And then after Shelby v. Holder, which we do an entire class on Shelby v. Holder, literally line by line, through Justice Roberts' majority opinion and Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg dissent. And we kind of go through the elements and the arguments, and we deconstruct and take it apart. Post-Shelby, you see all of the progress that has been made beginning to be whittled back.
Scale back.
Yep. And so it's a lesson for students, I think, to learn the power and impact of one piece of legislation. They learn everything that set the stage for that. You know, if John Lewis doesn't cross the bridge and get beaten, and it's not on the news, then, you know, we don't see the progress that we see. And so the role that activists play and the role moving public opinion plays, the role of elected officials, you know, LBJ had never supported a civil rights bill, you know, until just before he became president. He ended up becoming one of our greatest civil rights presidents ever. But his reluctance to do the Voting Rights Act after the Civil Rights Act, you know, you see all of these kind of things play out, and so you're seeing all aspects, and then the negotiations of the bill and the trade-offs that get made, and inevitably the compromises that get made in something as intense as the Voting Rights Act. There were still compromises that some of the you know, activists based in like. And then you see the implementation, but then you see the need to be vigilant to continue. And so you really encapsulate the whole kind of movement of an issue around one piece of legislation. And, you know, I can promise you this, if 20 years from now you ask a student of mine about the Voting Rights Act, they're going to know.
They're going to remember.
They're going to remember that
class.
And so, yeah, so I enjoy all the classes I teach at UCSD, but I really enjoy that one because it's very specific around that one piece of legislation. It's something you'll always carry with you.
That's awesome, man.
So
one of the things that we do on this podcast is talk about what are those moments that really stood out to you in your early childhood education or just your formative years, right? And so that's kind of what you're talking about, but not really in the formative years. Like, hey, like from your whole college experience, what did you remember the most? And you know what? I could tell you the general feeling that I got in the class. Like, I felt good in this professor's class.
Right.
But I probably couldn't tell you, oh, yeah, this one project, man. We got you know what I mean? We got so into that and that.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, a lot of this was shaped on my own. I mean, I had a great political science professor, Dr. Luther, who was really good and very patient with me.
At what institution?
So I went to a NAIA school in Riverside, California. Okay. Baptist University. I wasn't Baptist, but I had an academic. No, they didn't care. I had an academic and athletic scholarship there.
Okay.
And was a brilliant 17-year-old it's an interesting story, who kind of had things lined up to go to the Naval Academy, but thought I was going to be a professional baseball player, and I was not nearly as good as I thought I was when I was 17.
All right.
And that didn't end up working out. But the reason I got to wanting to do that goes back to an interesting experience that happened when I was in third grade. So I'm in rural South Arkansas, a tiny little town called Smackover, Arkansas. It was Smackover. It was French. No one could pronounce it. They molded them together, Smackover, Arkansas. 1,100 people in the town. We had one stoplight that works most of the time, not always. And it was just a factory working in an oil drilling town. And so everyone's parents pretty much worked either at the International Paper Factory plant, which is where my stepdad worked, or they worked in the oil fields. And, you know, just rural kind of working class kind of thing. Our school colors were black and white. They always told us we were too poor to afford color.
Wow.
You know, and so you did that. And, you know, there wasn't a lot of, you know, most folks kind of went into whatever line their parents were doing at that time, primarily what their dad did. And so, you know, we had been, you know, multiple generations of factory workers on our side. And I had, in third grade, we had a Navy pilot astronaut come to our class. He was visiting his girlfriend or so. I can't remember all the specifics, but I just remember he's there in his uniform. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's cool. I want to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
And so my teacher, Miss Glover, again, you know, you have these moments of great teachers. I was like, I really want to do that. And so she's like, all right. So we go to the office during recess, right? And we call, I don't know what to do. I said, well, we should call NASA and like tell them I want to be an astronaut. Mm-hmm. So she takes me to the office and we look up the number and we call. And this is, you know, when people answer the phones, you know, if you call NASA today, I'm pretty sure no person answers, right? But they answered and I said, I'm in third grade. I really want to be an astronaut. And they were like, that's great. They said, we have this little young astronauts program. And they got my address, and they sent me this box, and it had this binder with little science experiments in it, and it had some patches, and it had pictures of the different shuttle teams and the different space shuttles. And the lady on the phone, who was connecting me to the Young Astronauts Program, said, well, you should go to the Naval Academy and be a pilot. And I'm like, do you have their number? So then we call the Naval Academy, and the Naval Academy says, all right, if you want to come, you know, it doesn't matter where you came from, doesn't matter what your parents did, doesn't matter how much money you have. But you want to be senior class president, you want to be captain of the football team, you want to do National Honor Society, you want to make good grades. And I literally made a list of all of these things. And then they mailed me their catalog, you know, their thing. And man, I read that thing cover to front, and I would get one every year. And that's what I was going to do. I was going to go to the Naval Academy and be a pilot and then be an astronaut. And that motivated me, and that really kept me focused on what I wanted to do. Now, around ninth grade, I was sitting in the back of the room with my friend Jeff Davis. And the teacher's at the front of the room writing things on the board, and he's taking notes. And I said, what are you writing down? And he said, well, what she puts on the board. And I said, well, you can't see that. You know, and I would just hear, you know, I would just hear it verbally. And I said, you can't read the board from back here. And he goes, no, you can read the board. I had bad vision.
Okay.
So I had to get glasses, which at that time meant, well, you can't be a pilot.
You know?
And so that kind of crushed that dream. But I still graduated high school as senior class president, captain of the football team, National Honor Society, because I had got on a trajectory or a path. And so I think one of the things that's so important for kids, and at the time, you know, neither of my parents had graduated college. Now, my mom just graduated about a month ago.
That's awesome.
Yeah, she went back to school and had her cap and gown. And I'm really proud of her. But especially for kids who grew up in a family, you know, where maybe neither of their parents had the opportunity to go. Mm-hmm. They if we can inspire them with where they can see something and they can believe something is possible and they can know that there's a path, you know, where like, look, you can do this, and we have this program, we're going to pay for your school, and we have this thing, then I think it can really motivate and give direction. And if you can do that at an early age and tap into something that kid really aspires to and dreams of, I think it can be transformative for their life.
Absolutely important for them to see what the result could be for them. Absolutely. If you can't see it, then to some people, they don't even think to reach for it.
That's exactly right. And I see at UCSD, I always say my best students are my community college transfers, first generation, because they want it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they want it, and they've got a little chip. You know, hey, I belong here, and I want to be here. You know, my campaign manager for my campaign, Haiti Martinez, was a student of mine. Took 3 buses to get to UCSD. Dreamer, DACA recipient,
yeah.
You know, first one in her family. And you know, you watch folks like that graduate and then go on and do amazing things and just work. And so we have to make sure, whether it's our K through 12, whether it's our community college system, whether it's our higher education system, that we are creating an environment where these kids know, hey, you're going to have the support. You got to work hard, right? You got to want it. But we're going to make sure that we fulfill that promise of equity in terms of equity of access, meaning that everyone has an equal shot at success. You know, it'll always be easier if you're both your parents are PhD doctors. It's going to be easier for you.
Yeah.
But we got to make sure that, okay, if you didn't come out of that household, then we're going to make available some extra tutoring. We're going to give some extra resources. We're going to try and bridge that gap between equality and equity to make sure that you have the shot at success, which really is the underpinnings of the American dream, which is anyone, regardless of country of birth, regardless of circumstance, regardless of income or gender or race or sexual identification, anyone has an equitable shot at finding success and through hard work. And I think that's an important thing that we really have to strive to.
You brought up one of the big education buzzwords nowadays, one that I believe in firmly, which is equity.
Yes.
Right? So the not equality.
That's right. That's right.
Equity, right? How do we make sure that everybody's got a fair shot at access?
Yes.
But we're giving them the individualized tools that they need to
They need to have success. Well, and I think the difference between equity and equality, and it's maybe hard to describe in a podcast, but you know there's a great graphic that gets sent around a lot of kids of varying heights trying to look over the fence at a ball game.
Yeah.
You know, and the kid who's shorter needs a higher box.
Mm-hmm.
So that he has the chance to see over there. And if everyone had the equal size box, then the taller kid would always have a better view. And that's what I fundamentally believe, is that every child has to have an equitable shot at success, which means exactly that, which means some public schools are going to get a lot more funding than others. And we're going to provide more programs, and we need more services, and we need more tutoring and more mentoring for first generation college students, you know, because they're not going to have. I spent a lot of my time at UCSD simply opening doors for students to get internships. Now, if you're my child and you're in college and you want to do an internship, what's going to be really easy, right? You're just either going to ask your dad or your mom,
yep,
right? Because both of us will have that.
Got that access.
To do that. It's access. And well, we need to make sure that every child has someone, you know, who's striving to do that. Because if we don't do that, like, A, we're missing out on tremendous talent. I mean, tremendous talent. Talent is everywhere. Opportunity's not. It's just opportunity's not. And so how do you match opportunity to talent? And, you know, we talk in America a lot of times, and they'll say, well, these kids are falling behind. I said, these kids aren't falling behind. They were born behind.
Mm.
And we never do anything to help catch them up and get them there. And so I think tackling that bridge of equity versus equality is important. And you know, it comes up a lot in my campaign. People say, well, are we going to, in historically underserved communities, if you're elected supervisor, are we going to see you the same as every other community sees you? And I say, no, you're not. You're going to see me more. Hmm. Because if you've been historically underserved and left behind, and I treat everyone in an equal sense, we're never going to bridge up that divide. And so that's where I think you know, we have an obligation to address a lot of these historic injustices and try and catch up so we can strive for that place of a more equal society.
Interesting that you bring up the popular graphic of equality versus equity, the kids trying to watch the ball game. I got to give a shout out to my partner, Rodrigo Arancibia, who can't be here. He would say the problem's the wall.
Yeah, that's
what's
true.
What's the wall?
That's true.
Right?
Right.
Okay, we get the whole graphic. It's a ball game and whatnot, but what's actually the wall? We should be looking at that also.
No, and that's a fair point, too. I mean, that's a fair point. How do we get you over the wall? How do we lower the wall? Exactly. How do we simultaneously do both?
That's right.
I think that's fair.
All right, so we kind of got started without getting started.
Yeah.
Educated Guest Podcast, episode 33. I'm here with Nathan Fletcher for County Supervisor. District 4.
Yep.
Happens to be the old neighborhood that I grew up in all my life until I was about 24 years old. I left.
Where was that?
City Heights.
City Heights. That's where we live now.
I call it East San Diego. Nice people call it City Heights. The name's actually been switched back and forth over the years.
Right.
But a very culturally rich community. Just a lot of great people.
Wonderful.
A lot of great food. A lot of great events that happen there. I mean, I've probably been to the Kensington Street Fair maybe 20 years of my life.
Right.
What made you decide to run for county supervisor?
Well, county supervisor was a... I'll take a step back. I've always, I think, been motivated to serve. And I think that example came from my mom, who runs shelters for battered women and children. And every day she got up to try and fight and make a difference and help others. When I was in school, the Marine Corps ad, you know, if you watch the Marine Corps ads, they say there are those among us who run towards the sound of danger and tyranny and oppression and towards those in need of help. And that appealed to me. You know, maybe some of it was that male insecurity. We got to prove our toughness. But this notion that we would sacrifice ourselves to help others really appealed to me, and I joined the Marine Corps and spent a decade doing that. Then I got out. I ran for the state assembly, and I wanted to serve. I wanted to try and help people, and you know, did that. We had over 30 bills. We did Chelsea's Law. We did a lot of really important things. Lost a campaign for mayor, and you know, that's okay. We went for it, and then subsequent to that, went in the private sector where I learned a lot. I was working at a large company, traveling around the world, but predominantly what I learned is that's not what I want to do with my life. I'm not motivated in the pursuit of profit. You know, you want to be able to take care of your family, but I didn't buy anything new in 4 years, getting paid very well in the private sector. I didn't buy a new car. I didn't buy any. I'm just not. That's not what drives me. Mm-hmm. What drives me is a sense of purpose and making a difference and helping others. Mm-hmm. And so I got real involved in doing veterans' mental health work.
You yourself are a veteran. You've done a couple of tours.
I did a couple tours. I fought in the recent wars.
I don't think we can't get away from that fact. That's a integral part of who you are and what you do.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that's an interesting thing. It is a part of who you are. Mm. I mean, it's like being a Marine was what I did, but it was also who I am.
That call to serve
and that willing to sacrifice. Mm-hmm. You know, when you have a group of folks who will literally give their life for someone else because they, you know, they believe in what they're doing. And then when I came back and I, you know, in the private sector, I'm not serving. I'm serving myself and I'm serving the company and I'm not. And so I got real involved in a number of issues surrounding mental health treatment for veterans. We have this epidemic of veteran suicide.
Yeah.
And as a country, we are very proficient at making combat veterans. There's rarely a war we can't walk past. And we go all in and we fight them for a really long time and we make a lot of them. We are not very proficient at taking care of them when they come back.
Ooh. Fair point. Good
you know,
point.
And a country that has the moral authority to send young men and women to war has the moral obligation to care for them when they come back.
Absolutely.
And a country that has the resources to send you to war. There's never a budget conversation. We never let a budget or cost issue slow us down when it comes to making veterans. Wow, we just support the troops. Whatever we need, we spend. But then when it comes to, hey, we got all these cats and they're homeless and they got post-traumatic stress and they've got severed limbs and they're like, oh, wow, the VA budget's too expensive.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? Like you didn't have any too expensive concerns on the front end when you made them.
That's right.
And it's all upside down, and we don't think about the moral injury and the long lasting impact that happens with these things. And so I got real involved in helping these folks, and so I started a nonprofit. We went and raised $1 million to try and help, which is not an insignificant amount. But then I read the grand jury report that the county of San Diego was sitting on at that time about $168 million of unspent mental health funds.
Oh.
And I remember having this moment where I was like, gosh, if I want to help veterans and I care about mental health, all right, I just raised $1 million, but it took me a little while.
And they got 168.
And they got 168 sitting there. And I thought, well, you almost have the obligation because campaigns aren't fun. I mean, they're not pleasant. And I thought, you know, and I almost had this guilt. Like, it's almost like, yeah, I know if I get in that position, I can move a lot of that money. I'm never going to raise that much money. And if I care about helping these kids, you almost have the obligation to try and get in a position to have them more aggressively spend their funds in a more progressive manner. But it wasn't just mental health.
Okay.
Right? They're not. They have one half the public health nurses they're required by law to have. That's why we had a hepatitis outbreak. They have a climate action plan that is not consistent with a greenhouse gas reduction plan or the basic concepts of environmental justice. They are not moving forward in areas to really invest in transit. Mm-hmm. They aren't taking care of their foster kids. They voted themselves a 19% pay raise while they screw their workers. You have county workers who are eligible for the services they provide. And across the board, it's just a culture. It's an all five Republican culture that's been there for a long time. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to go in a new direction. And so that really got me there, this notion that we could tackle this entity and we could begin to drive change. And it would be change that would have a real impact in folks' lives. And we could see that change directly. And it won't come immediately and it won't be easy. But if we're successful in doing what we're doing, we're talking about billions of dollars and hundreds of thousands of lives that get touched. And I can't think of anything more productive I could do with the next decade of my life than dedicate it towards trying to change and transform our county government into something that really touches people's lives. And if I could do that, then we could see that change in effect. And I could forever look back and personally, you know, have a sense of fulfillment that, hey, I shouldered my share of the load. I did what I could do to try and make our community a little bit better place. And if we get it on a better trajectory, it won't change back.
That's amazing, man. You really pinpointed exactly why you're doing this. I can appreciate that. One of the big issues that we've seen over the past, I don't know, let's say 15 years or so, is just the changes that come with growth in a city, right? We've seen the gentrification in Logan Heights. I'm starting to see it in Chula Vista where I live. And then, you know, just that growth, people want nice things, they want new things, but, you know, with that change comes some responsibility.
Right.
Like, what's your whole vision or take on that?
Well, we have, and we're starting to see it in City Heights even a little.
A little bit, yeah.
A little bit, not as much, and certainly not as much as like Golden Hill or some of those other areas.
Oh, yeah.
So I think these are hard. These are difficult issues because folks, you know, you want, to your point, you want nicer things, but then it gets more expensive and people get priced out. Yep. And especially if you're a renter or, you know, if you own and then you have this tremendous pressure about what I could sell for this amount and what I could do with that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a number of things we have to do. One of them is we have not in a sustained way tackled the issue of wages for working class folks in San Diego.
Okay.
And I think we have to do, you know, and this is also complex, but at all levels of government, we have to push. I mean, when you have a time where the stock market is roaring, where profits are roaring, but wages are stagnant,
mm-hmm.
that's not a good situation.
No.
And so tackling this ever-growing gap of income inequality can help in a lot of ways if folks are able to, you know, have one good quality job and pay the bills and sustain it, then I think that's important. But the second is, particularly when it comes to housing, is we really have to tackle this issue of ensuring that there is affordable housing, ensuring that we are increasing the supply, but we're increasing the supply in a way that is affordable for folks who are working and live in that neighborhood. And we have to be mindful that you know, you have a lot of these neighborhoods who have great historic culture.
Yep.
And you can't lose that. That has to be preserved, and that's a part of our culture, that's a part of our communities, that's a part of our neighborhoods. And when you think about the fabric of, you know, neighborhoods in so many ways tie us together, and they bind us together, and they hold us together. And so really, you know, being smart about how you make sure that folks who grew up in that environment, that neighborhood, are able to stay there, but also that, you know, the life that they knew, the culture that they knew, the things that they knew are preserved. Are things that as we do this planning and we start talking about transit and density and all these other types of things, is really taken into account.
There's a lot of moving pieces, right? And one of those moving pieces is MTS. And I wondered what your thought, if you had any thoughts on the things that have been going on recently with MTS.
Well, I think MTS under Georgette Gomez, who's the new chair, I'm a big fan of hers.
I'm a big fan too. Went to state with her.
Yeah, she's great. We've only opened our house once, and it was a fundraiser for Georgette.
Okay,
when she ran, I'm excited. You know, the county has a rep at MTS, and you know, I have to get through the election. We have to win, but you know, it would be great to at some point fill that role for the county, given that my district encapsulates, you know, a lot of the MTS service area.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what we're talking about there, and now with the legislation that my wife did around AB 805, you know, you see a situation where you have revenue raising authority in the MTS service area.
Okay.
And so we could potentially go to the voters in 2020 in that area with a plan that actually gets us on that pathway to making sure we have real transit, and we have real transit options, especially for a lot of the service workers who come out of the South Bay, who head up into downtown to make sure that they can get there and they can get back.
Mm-hmm.
But just yesterday, we were driving to a Labor Day event at the MLK Rec Center.
Okay.
And I was just struck by, and I've seen them before, I live right in that area, but there's little things that MTS could be doing. You know, you have, when you read the market research surrounding transit, in terms of increasing ridership and participation, you know, they need to be train-like. They don't need to be trains, but they need to be train-like, which means having grade separated, having standalone bus lanes.
Okay.
You know, you're not going to ride a bus that sits in the same traffic you'd sit in a car.
Terrible.
But so there's a lot of things we need to do there, and where they pick you up and that last mile and where they drop you off is all important. But one of the basic things is the point at which you enter the transit needs to be sheltered, and it needs to be sheltered from the sun. It needs to be sheltered from the rain. It still rains 40 days a year here. It needs to be sheltered from vehicles where you feel like you're in a safe environment. It needs to be sheltered. And we're driving down, and I'm looking at these MTS bus stops, and half of them don't even have a bench.
Mm.
much less do they not have a shelter. And so you have people waiting for the bus who are standing off to the side under a tree.
There's just a sign, or they're sitting on a planter.
Yeah, and it's like, gosh almighty, can we provide a bench? Can we provide a covering? Can we provide shelter?
I wouldn't want to ride that neither.
And so I think we have a lot of work to do, from a transit standpoint. I don't understand how there's no transit to the airport. That's not just for travelers. That's for the workers who go to work there every day. How do we not have transit to the airport? I mean, these are just things that just don't make a lot of sense, and things that I think we need to tackle. And as we have this rub of the city or region we want to be in the future versus the city we have been, I think we really have to start tackling, a lot of these mindsets surrounding issues like transit, and MTS, and then to a bigger issue, Sandag.
Have to
move their thinking in a way that better accommodates the future that we need. And absolutely. I think Georgette has great ideas and approaches and plans on where she wants to take MTS, and I look forward to fully supporting her efforts.
I can't get away from the fact that it's the day after Labor Day, and we're sitting here in union offices. Uh-huh. I myself am a union member.
Uh-huh. As am I?
Treasurer of my union.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah, AFT.
All right on, man. So one of the things that's come up in our local school board, just the idea of PLAs and the emotion and energy that brings along with it.
Right.
What's your take? What are your feelings on PLAs?
Well, no, I support project labor agreements. Mm-hmm. First off, it helps things get built on time, on budget, in a quality way. You're using a skilled and trained workforce. Mm-hmm. You have local hire provisions so that those tax dollars that are spent, investing, are being taken by locals here who are gonna gain that employment and reinvest that in the local economy. Mm-hmm. But it's also important when we're building these public assets that we make sure we have skilled and trained workforce. And I went to airborne school in the military, where you jump out of planes, and the last thing I wanted was someone to say, "Here's your parachute. It was built by the cheapest, most irresponsible contractor ever. Good luck." But yet, then when you come in to, hey, we're going to build a school,
yeah,
and you say, we're going to make sure we use skilled and trained workforce, and we're going to build it to last, and we're going to make sure, then people are like, no. Come on, what are we doing here? It's an investment.
And we're going to hire a majority of the people from here in
Our region. And the economic impact of that alone, mm-hmm, is taking those tax dollars. I mean, this same conversation about investing locally comes up a lot. One of the things that the county... Our home health care workers, right? Mm-hmm. Our home health care workers work hard. Yeah. It is a hard, difficult job. And they care for folks, and they provide for folks, and they do these types of things. And morally, who wants to have the elderly, the seniors, the infirmed
not getting crappy care?
Getting crappy care. I mean, it's just wrong. But the second thing is, it's cheaper. It's cheaper than putting them in a nursing home facility, or it's certainly cheaper than having them untreated to where it gets to a devastating, severe situation that requires hospitalization and emergency room visits. But the county pays the home health care workers, but 85 cents of every dollar they pay is reimbursed by the state and federal government.
Yeah.
Why do we not pay them to the maximum amount? Because that home health care worker is going to spend every dollar they make here in the community. So I'm going to give you a dollar raise. I'm going to get 85 cents of it back. That means I'm only paying 15 cents to give you a dollar. Now you're going to spend that dollar, which means I'm going to get part of that back in sales tax.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Why would we not increase your hours and do these types of things? Because it's an investment in helping, kind of stimulate that thing. And I think that local hire provisions of project labor agreements, in addition to the skilled and trained workforce issues, and those types of things are important. In addition to things, they get built on time, and they get built on budget, and they get built to last.
We're going to take a small break. We talking fair wages and labor. We talking smart growth. Nathan Fletcher talking big things. As usual on the podcast, we need to thank the supervisor of sound, our man on the boards, Ed Nunez. Welcome to the Educated Guest Podcast, y'all. Nathan Fletcher for County Board of Supervisor. We about to get back into it, and I'm going to throw the man for a little curveball. I'm going to ask him about recent legislation and one of Mr. AYYY's favorite pastimes. Let's get into this. Nathan Fletcher, back at it. Here we go. want to ask you, what are your thoughts on the recent legislation that passed surrounding recreational and medical marijuana? Didn't the county board of supervisors
voted to ban it?
Now, where is it banned at, though? I don't get
that. So it's banned in the unincorporated area. And so each city has the ability, they have the land use jurisdiction within the confines of their city. And so City of San Diego put in place a cannabis policy for the City of San Diego. City of Oceanside can do what they want. City of Poway can do what they want. But in the unincorporated territory, a lot of it out east, some of it up in the north, and then some random little pockets, some of it down south, is the unincorporated territory. And I think what the county did was absolutely, completely the wrong thing to do. We need a cannabis policy that is safe, regulated, and legal.
Mm-hmm.
And other jurisdictions are moving in a way to get us to that point. And, you know, if someone comes in and they say, well, I'm a prohibitionist, I'm opposed to legal alcohol, right? And we tried that in our country, and folks should go back, and there's this great Ken Burns documentary on the prohibition era, and you'll realize why it was just a train wreck of public policy.
Mm.
But if someone says that, I'll say, I think your thinking is flawed, and I think you have the wrong approach, but I understand where you're coming from, and that same person can therefore be opposed to cannabis. Right? On the same logic.
Same logic, yeah.
But if you don't support the prohibition of alcohol, then you have no intellectual foundation upon which to oppose the legalization of cannabis in the same way we do alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
Regulated, legal, taxed.
I hear some of the worst arguments against marijuana
when you go to
these like city council meetings.
They're just so much of it's just uninformed. And it's the same folks who go home and, you know, have a six-pack.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, that's okay, but the other's not okay. And I've seen it with veterans. You know, they go to the VA pumps them full of opioids, which actually are addictive, actually are a gateway, actually create real problems. So many of them have used cannabis and just say, well, you know, it lowers the volume, it helps them, it treats them. I was telling somebody, I said, imagine you're stuck in the middle seat of a crowded international airline flight for 14 hours and you're in pain. Well, that's what some folks who are confined to a wheelchair or other circumstances, I mean, that's their daily life.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't, you know, I don't just support it for medicinal purposes. I support it for recreational purposes. But it needs to be.
Yeah, no,
and I have. But it needs to be safe because the same reason we don't have medicinal alcohol.
We don't. No.
Right? Or recreational alcohol.
Okay.
We just have alcohol. Now it's safe. It's regulated. It's legal. If you abuse it, you pay a penalty for it. I mean, it has to be, you know, we have to make sure that, you know, we enforce those basic things that keep everyone safe. But I don't want, if we don't do that, folks who want cannabis are still going to get it.
Absolutely. Always have.
Always have. So the question is, do I want you to get it in an area where it hasn't been tested? We aren't sure what's in it. We don't know where it came from.
Mm-hmm.
And the cartels or someone else makes all the money.
Mm-hmm.
No. I got a lot of stuff I want to do at the county. I want to help foster kids. I want to help veterans. I want to help refugees and immigrants. No, I'm going to tax the shit out of it. Right? And we're going to take that money. We're going to do a lot of good with it.
Mm-hmm.
But that requires we have a system that is safe, regulated, and legal. We have to tackle cultivation and testing and manufacturing and delivery and all of the various components. And I would like to see the county, and we're a ways away from this, given they voted to ban it.
Yeah.
I would like to see us really come up with a model ordinance. Right? What is the model ordinance? Because you got to have some flexibility in pricing, because if you set the levels of taxation too high, you start driving it underground.
Yep, push it right back
you
in the black market.
You push it right back in the black market.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to find that threshold. You know, I think people would pay more to go to a place that's safe, regulated, and legal because they know what they're getting,
mm-hmm.
but more to a point, right? It can't be twice as much. And so you got to figure that out. We have to have proper enforcement. We've got to tackle these issues of driving and work and, you know, these types of things like we do with alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to see the county have a policy for the unincorporated area that tackles all of these issues. But if we got it right, it could become the model ordinance. And then some of the smaller cities could simply adopt the model ordinance. And then we could have a consistency over areas. And so I'd like to see the county have an Office of Cannabis Research and Policy. We're actually doing research on this. We're actually, you know, investing in tracking outcomes. The testing the various components, and then really develop this puddle, and then you know, have the flexibility as this industry emerges. You know, you're seeing new things that are going to pop up, and you got to have the flexibility to do that. And I have a little experience, not in cannabis policy, but when I was in the assembly, Mm-hmm. I had these folks come to me. Now, keep in mind, this was a decade ago. So okay. Everyone thinks, oh, God, that's crazy. So a decade
it's
ago.
Really not that long ago.
A decade ago. But so I had these folks wanted to meet, and they were with the craft beer industry.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I said,
they were early on the game.
I said, what the hell is that?
Yeah, yeah.
Craft beer? Because a decade ago, you didn't know. It just wasn't, you know.
I'm cool with this Budweiser.
Yeah,
cool,
you know. Yeah. So they said, oh, they like brew beer. I'm like at home? Like in a like bathtub? What are they, like, I grew up in Arkansas. Like, moonshine? What are they doing here? So I meet with them, and they tell me, yeah, we brew our own beer, and we're, you know, 2% of the market, and we can't get our beer in restaurants, and we can't get our beer in grocery stores because the big brands control the distribution. And so the only way we can do it is we need to open tasting rooms like you have with wine tasting rooms.
Yeah.
And you come, and you try our product, you see if you like it, and then you buy it direct from us, and we give you a case, or we ship you a case, or we mail you a case, or whatever. I said, well, then open a beer tasting room. They said, well, we can't. California law doesn't allow it. And so I authored the legislation, which created beer tasting rooms. They had never existed in the state of California. And there was no vehicle. You had to open as a restaurant, but that's really expensive.
Okay.
And so we did that. We did that almost 10 years ago. But we had to work with the Department of Public Health. We had to figure out the permitting and the inspecting and, you know, all the various components that did it, how many there could be. You know, we had to work through a lot of those issues, but it was tremendously successful because now
you voted for it or you helped?
I was
author
the author.
It?
No, I was
that's
the author.
What's up.
I was the author.
People should vote for you on that alone.
Yeah, I drove the legislation. So every beer tasting room in existence in the state of California today only exists because of the legislation we did almost a decade ago.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
Yeah, and now we see the impact, and it's been great. And a lot of them have gone on to become restaurants, and now they're in the supply chain, distribution chain, and those types of things. But they literally could not. There was no way for them legally to exist. And so, you know, we can see the success with these types of things, and we just need to replicate that when it comes to cannabis.
I know we're running short on time.
Yeah.
I still want to just one more thing with the weed thing, and I'm not arguing with you at all.
Yeah.
I was a little disappointed with Chula Vista. Mayor Silas is a friend of my family. Their marijuana ordinance, it had no peace in it for those folks that had been convicted of a marijuana crime. Being able to even work in one of the businesses.
Right.
And I felt like that was a terrible travesty because we've seen other counties across the state, Oakland being one of them, have a really progressive marijuana,
sure.
Not bill, what is it?
Well, if we've decided it today something is no longer a crime,
mm-hmm.
right? Then it's awfully hard for us to say, okay, so we've determined as a society that this is legal.
Mm-hmm.
But 5 years ago, we convicted you of something that we now think is okay. How do we continue to hold that against you?
Right.
And that has never made a lot of sense to me.
No.
And so, like, we have to do things to try and address those and really, you know, reach back and look at, you know. And then the other thing is there's a systematic, you know, you want to talk about inequity, look at sentencing in the criminal justice system.
Yeah.
And look at who would get sentenced and who would get charged. You know, when I did Chelsea's Law, this is a little known piece. Chelsea's Law was a massively large bill that tackled the issue of violent sexual predators. And when we started that, we said, look, justice is blind, not dumb. We're not doing dumb things. And I said, I want a bill for people we're afraid of, not people we're mad at. And there's a difference.
Mm.
There's a difference. So the 18-year-old with the 17-year-old girlfriend, you're mad at them,
mm-hmm.
right? You're not afraid of them. John Gardner, who violently sexually assaults young girls and kills them, we're afraid of him.
Yeah.
That's who jail's for. Jail is not for the 21-year-old who's walking home drunk and urinates in a park, and that park happens to be near a school, right? That person is technically, well, no, we're not talking about that, right? But the other thing consistent with justice, so when we did Chelsea's Law, we increased penalties for the John Gardners of the world, people that violently sexually assault young children. And as a parent, those folks belong in jail.
Absolutely.
We provided better treatment for those lower than that who are going to get out. Because if you're going to get out, we want you to not reoffend, right? We want you to find success.
Mm-hmm.
But the way we paid for that bill was we went through the whole criminal justice system, and I found petty theft with a prior. Now, petty theft with a prior is essentially shoplifting, right? And you'd probably done it before. The majority of those folks were shoplifting to feed their drug habit, right? And as you looked at it, it was what was called a wobbler, meaning DAs could charge it as a felony or they could charge it as a misdemeanor.
Oh, wow.
Right? They had that discretion. Now, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to look at the numbers and figure out, well, if it was me who got arrested,
uh-huh.
oh, I got charged as a misdemeanor.
Yeah.
Because I had a lawyer, I had this. was a person of color, lower income, then it got charged as a felony because they would use it to jack up their felony conviction rates. Felony sends you to state prison. Misdemeanor sends you county treatment. You need to go to county treatment because you have a substance abuse issue.
Yep.
So I changed it. I took away the wobbler. I said, it's a misdemeanor. We're going to get you in treatment. And so that's, again, was a decade ago. Now we're lowering drug offenses to provide treatment. We did that in Chelsea's Law a decade ago. And I think that we have to adhere to that same mindset that when it comes to a lot of these drug offenses, when it comes to cannabis-related things from the past, we've now determined that's legal and that's fine. But even some of the ones that were tied to some of the harder offenses, if you weren't dealing and you were using, you're addicted. And no one shows up at the hospital having smoked for 40 years with cancer and we say, well, we can't help you because you're addicted to a substance.
Yeah.
Right? And it's only these substances. And I also think it's important to recognize that so much of the conversation around addiction and substance abuse today is driven by the opioid crisis. And, you know, I was at an event in a North County-ish kind of thing, and they said, God, we got to do something about this opioid crisis and our kids, and they're doing these pain pills, and then they're getting addicted. And I said, I agree with you. I said, I agree with you. We do. I said, but I also think it's important that we recognize, right, that we have a lot of kids whose parents have really good health insurance who get overprescribed pain pills, and the kids get them, and the kids get addicted to it, and then it leads to other things, and they need treatment. I said, but 20 years ago, we had a bunch of kids get addicted to stuff, too.
Yeah.
And it was crack. And nobody wanted to talk about treatment. Now, they were kids, and they got addicted to something, and addiction is real. Mm-hmm. And we need to treat it as a sickness and as a disease and a condition, medical condition. And I said, but then it was, we just want to lock them up, and today it's they just need treatment. I said, what's the difference between the two categories of kids? And everyone's heads went down. And I said, you know, I'm not saying that we're wrong. I said, but I think we need to be historically cognizant of the fact that what we are now treating as a medical condition for one category of kids, there are people still sitting in prison for doing the exact same thing.
That's a tough conversation to have, but it needs to be had in order to come up with a system that does treat young people equitably, but also treats them if they have an addiction, right? Instead of just locking them up. That's so right. It's a tough conversation, and that's why the heads went down.
Yeah.
But it's got to be had.
It's got to be had, and we just, you know, we have to.
And the other thing with the medical marijuana is that, according to the analysis of the state proposition that passed, even though it does create funds for education, it doesn't mandate that those funds go to education. It kind of creates this like slush fund.
Right.
One thing we got to do locally, man, is we got to make sure that money goes where it belongs.
Well, and getting it down in the local schools. And that's where, I mean, a lot of these things, and this is where I think there's that proper oversight and rigor. So, like, you know, I can remember being in the legislature asking a lot of questions about the lottery. How much money's actually, like, where is it going?
Yeah.
You know, like, where is it going and how many steps does it take on the way to get there?
Uh-huh.
And I think with cannabis, we really need to be transparent in the revenue that comes in from there and what is the return.
Absolutely.
But you should do that across the board in government. I mean, across the board, you know, there's this notion about elected officials are like, you know, it's mine. Well, it's not your money. You're the steward of everyone else's money. And so I think being mindful and being open with how it's being spent. And also, look, and this is another hard conversation. I'm a metrics-obsessed person. I mean, everything's measurable. You know, I wake up in the morning, and the first thing I do is I look at my app to see how I slept the night before. What was my heart rate? What zone was I in? You know, how? And, you know, I come into the campaign, and, you know, I can tell you exactly this is how many votes we need identified today. Uh-huh. This is how much money we got to raise today. Every day I can tell you, are we above or behind where we should be? And there's a lot of functioning in government that needs to be done the same. So if you're a nonprofit or a county agency, either one, and we're going to give you money, I need to know, well, what's your number, right? What do you do with that money?
Absolutely.
Right. And then how do we make sure, is that the right thing or the wrong thing? But then did you do that or did you not do that?
Mm.
Right. And if you did that, you know, if it's your job to help foster, how many kids and what were the outcomes? And, you know, one of the things I've talked about for probation, for example, probation is the gateway to reentry, right? It's the path to rehabilitation. And if you're getting out, we can all agree we don't want you to go back, right? We don't want you to go back because we don't want you to commit more offenses. We don't want you to go back because it's really expensive. And we don't want you to go back because we're humans and we want you to have a quality life, right? Not one where you're constantly caught up in the criminal justice system.
Yeah.
Well, our probation officers, who I think the overwhelming majority of them are terrific, and they go in this line of work because they want to help people, are understaffed. They have too many cases. They can't invest the time, and they don't have the resources to get you on a pathway to success. The County Board of Supervisors last year slashed the budget of probation by $20 million at a period where they have a higher workload, because in the criminal justice reform era, we're getting more people on a pathway back. And so I've said, well, why don't we take probation and say, let's say that individual's on probation. The job is not to get them off probation. The job is to get them reentered. So we're going to track that person 1 year, 3 years, 5 years post-probation, and we're going to measure, are they sheltered? Are they employed? Have they had no negative interactions with law enforcement? Are they meeting their financial obligations? And are they, you know, sober, or, you know, if they had some sobriety type issues? And we're going to give them a score, 1 year, 3 years, and 5 years. And that score is how we're going to evaluate the success of probation. Well, now, if you're probation, your whole mindset just shifted.
Mm-hmm.
So wait a minute. What I get held accountable for is their successful reentry.
Yeah.
Not just taking care of you while you're here. Now, we got to give them more resources. We cannot give them more responsibility.
And less money.
And less money.
Or the same money.
You know, you can't. Yeah. But imagine if the shift was focused on the outcome, right? The outcome being successful reentry. Imagine if the foster care system were graded on the percentage of them that got a trade or a community college or a four-year degree or a skill, you know, and so we're trying to figure out what are the outcomes that we want, and then how do we incentivize and create a culture that tries to match those outcomes and then provides the resources to get there.
It's the same thing with education. It's like, okay, so one of our metrics of success is how many kids we get into college, but how many kids are actually getting through college
and graduating.
Once they're in there,
yeah.
Because a lot of them don't.
A lot of them don't. Well, and that's where our college systems have an obligation that, okay, you qualified, you got in here.
Mm-hmm.
Now we got to make sure you have the capacity to get through.
Yeah.
And, you know, that goes back to equity in terms of you know, helping. So, I mean, look, my community college students, they're smart. They're really smart. But they haven't, you know, they may not have as much experience at that level. And so we got to be patient, and we got to help them. It's not that they aren't smart. It's not that they don't have the capacity for it. It's just, you know, there's an experience differential there. And, you know, we can do a lot throughout K through 12. We can do a lot at community college. We can do a lot at higher education to try and bridge that gap. Because again, you know, I said earlier, talent's everywhere. Opportunity is not.
Yeah. Okay. And the whole reason my partner isn't here today is because he started a new graduate program with High Tech High, where they actually are going to track the kids that they help get in college, because they're trying to build capacity getting them through there too.
Right.
That's part of what his grant is, and that's why he couldn't be here. He's the funny guy of the podcast. you know, one of the reasons you came on our radar was we had heard that you had given a top five MCs list or something like that, and we heard Dre was on that list, and I'm just scratching my head like, did he really say Dre?
I did.
I mean, so, Dre's got some good songs to bump in the ride. He's not really an MC.
I know. And we got. Well, it was funny because here's what happened. What happened was, it was kind of funny. So I'm a fan of, in today's world as a candidate, you need to be accessible.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
And we don't hide behind these walls. If there's 12 people you got to go to talk to me, or you got to hire a lobbyist, or, like, you know, we just don't do that. So I go walk door to door almost every day.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I hit my doors. I knock. I talk to folks. And in the campaign, we were just getting pummeled. I mean, the Republicans spent like $2 million just hammering us in, and it was just garbage. And we're trying to tell people, like, look, you know, don't believe the Republican-funded lies.
Those
and
are
so
lies.
So I made a – they aren't on these ones. Where are they here? These are the old ones. But basically what we did was I just made the decision. I said, look, I'm going to fight for every vote. And so I put my cell phone on a mailer. I said, don't believe these Republican-funded lies. If you have questions about my record, about what we want to do, call me directly on my cell phone.
Gutsy move.
And a lot of folks, you know, they're kind of campaign professionals, like, whoa, I don't know, that's such a good idea. And I said, what's going to happen? Is a voter going to call me? Like, but don't I spend the bulk of my day trying to talk to voters? Like, why would that be a bad thing?
Yeah.
And they said, well, like, you know, people may call and be rude. And I'm like, well, I fought in two wars. Like, okay. I'll survive.
Yeah.
I've had death threats. I mean, it's, you know, okay, well, then I'll just hang up. But I said, I want to do it. And I said, I think it's important. So we did. We put it in a mailer to 100,000 people. And then someone said, well, we'll get a phone. No, no, no. I said, it has to actually be my phone, right? This has to, if we're doing this real, it has to be real. And so we put my cell phone, which is 858-249-8233. You call it, it'll ring in my pocket right now. Mm-hmm. And we put it in the mailer. And then we did a texting program from my actual phone. And I was sitting and responding to people. And I got a lot of people say, oh, this isn't you. I said, no, it's me. And they said, take a selfie. I take a selfie. And then they go, oh, that's your bot. And they're like, all right, close one eye and make a peace sign, take a selfie, you know. And I did, you know, it was like a hostage verification, you know, video. And
your captcha.
One guy's like, write my name on a piece of paper and hold it up in front of you. And,
oh,
you know,
my God.
But it was fine. And then literally. And then I got a lot of people were like, well, that's really cool. That's actually you. And I said, yeah, it's actually me. And I said, in all my faults and flaws and imperfections, but, you know, real commitment to service, you know, what do you have on, what's on your mind? What question can I ask? And so I did get a few random, you know, questions. And one guy said, I'll vote for you if you can tell me your, you know,
your top five MCs.
And so I kind of went with it. And then the guy loved it. And he said, oh my God, this is great. And, you know, and then of course it set off this whole debate about why'd you pick this one and not that one? And it was fun. You know, it was very, very fun. And
I don't remember who you picked. Tell me some of the people you picked.
Oh my gosh. I'd have to pull it up right now.
Just
I think
it's in constant flux anyway.
So I had Dre was in there, Eminem,
okay,
Nas, three.
That's cool, man. That's good enough.
Yeah,
Nas is my number one. My
favorite. Yeah,
of all
time. He was an, you know, an easy one.
So we good.
You know, Eminem was good. You know, and then I got Dre Way. He doesn't really fit. You know, kind of. You know, yeah, I know.
It's your list, bro. It's your list. Right,
so yeah, that's what I told people. I said, well, you put out your five lists, and then I'll pick that apart
for sure. For sure.
But I do think that there's a broader point in that. In today's world, like I do my own social media.
Uh huh.
Right. So if you comment on my Facebook post and I comment back, that's actually me.
Okay.
If you tweet at me and I tweet back at you, that's actually me.
Mm.
And I can't always get to all of them because sometimes you're busy and you're doing that. But, you know, we had a thing on Saturday or Sunday. We did a post in the morning and some guy went on. It was just being just ridiculous. And I responded to him and I said, no, asshole. Like, that's not true, you know. And then I debunked everything he said. Well, it was actually not true. And then someone's like, yeah, you know, man, you're right. You probably shouldn't have called him an asshole. And I'm like, yeah, you're probably right.
It was the moment.
Then that's so I told this. So I replied back to the guy and I said, hey, man, I apologize for calling you an asshole. I said, I probably, you know, that's what I felt, but it probably wasn't appropriate. So I said, I'm going to edit that out. I said, I just think you're just a right wing nut who spews things that aren't true. And I said, and it can be a little frustrating, not that I'm without fault or certainly not that I shouldn't be criticized. But we're just in this Trumpian environment where you can just say stuff that's just not true.
Yeah.
And I think every now and then, you know, as a candidate, you'll kind of make a mistake and you'll call someone an asshole and you probably shouldn't do that. But I think on the whole, being more accessible and being more open and folks knowing that, you know, they can call you. And frankly, most of the calls I got to my phone were just people just curious if it was actually my phone.
Gotcha.
And then they thought that was cool. They're like, yeah, I don't really have a question for you. I just think it's cool. I can call.
Right.
And if I win, I've committed, I'll do a series of town halls, you know, in every neighborhood, different neighborhoods. And, you know, anyone can show up and ask your question or share what's on your mind. You know, again, like, you know, you don't have to hire a lobbyist and you don't have to go through five, you know, layers of folks.
We're not going to see you hiding on the roof of a house or
no.
in a bush, right? No, you're not going to be hiding from the town halls.
No, none of that. And, you know, look, I had issues in the assembly where I confronted unpopular issues.
Uh-huh.
One of them was the La Jolla Seals.
Okay.
So I represented La Jolla, and the district I'm running for now includes La Jolla as well. Man, you talk about some single issue folks.
Yeah.
And Chris Kehoe and I were doing the legislation, which, long story short, would basically allow him to stay. Was the long and short of it. That wasn't the bill, but the bill gave that as an option. And there's a lot of complicated reasons why I think that's the only viable option. Whether you want him there or you don't want him there, I think that's the only viable outcome. But I really didn't care. I mean, I just didn't. I had to take a position on it, and it was my district. And so, and there was a group of folks who really care, and to this day, still continue to really care.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, well, I'll do a town hall on this issue in La Jolla. And all the security folks like, no. I mean, we get death threats. And I said, man, it's La Jolla. What are they going to hit me with their wine glass?
Yeah.
I said, it'll be all right. We'll survive. I said, I survived Fallujah and Yemen and, you know, Somalia. Like, yeah. We can handle this.
All right.
And I walked in, and this lady, as I was walking in, she was shaking, and she's like, I hate you. I hate you. And I was like, oh, my gosh, you know.
You could feel it, huh?
Yeah. Oh, it was tense. It was tense. And the only people who showed up was the people who were opposed to what I was doing, and there was a lot of them. But I told them all at the beginning, I said, hey, I want you all to know that I respect your passion. Right? I respect your passion. Like, you care about something, and you care enough about something that you're at a town hall at 7 o'clock on a Thursday.
Threatening, no.
Yeah, and, you know, and I said, enough for you, who are the exceptions, or, you know, doing these sorts of stuff. And I said, but I respect your passion. I said, but I also want you to know I don't share it. Mm. I said, I'm going to be completely honest. I really don't care. I said, now, I've taken a position because it's an issue impacting my district, and I have to confront it. Mm-hmm. And I said, and there's a lot of misinformation. And I said, you know, everyone's entitled to their own opinion, but not their own facts. And I said, we're going to walk through the facts behind what I did and why. And I said, but we have kids who aren't reading at grade level. I said, we got people that are having to live an hour and a half away from their work. That's 3 hours a day they don't spend with their kids. I said, we have areas and beaches that are so polluted you can't get in them. I said, we have substantive issues. We have people who have been working more hours at the same job for less money for the last decade. I said, we have real substantive issues. Mm-hmm. And I said, if this is your number one issue in life, I think you're doing all right.
Very much so.
You know?
Very much so.
And so, and then by the end of it, people were okay, and maybe they understood. And so I think you shouldn't shy away from criticism. You shouldn't shy away from uncomfortable situations. And some folks you'll never satisfy, but a lot of folks you hope at the end of the day they go, well, I disagree with him, but you know what? I think he's trying. You know, he's looking at facts. He's listening to folks. He's trying to do what he thinks right, and I may disagree with the outcome he came to. But, you know, I appreciate the process. And then, you know, a segment of folks you're never going to win over, and that's okay too.
All right. I want to be respectful of your time.
Yeah.
But I got a tough one, Nathan.
Yeah.
I got a tough one that I got to throw at you. We are sitting here the day after Nike announced that Colin Kaepernick would be the face of their 30-year anniversary of their Just Do It campaign.
Yep.
As a veteran, you know, this is used issues all over the place, man. Yeah. So what are your thoughts on the Take a Knee and Colin Kaepernick campaign?
Well, I went to war. And I signed up and took an oath, and I was willing to give my life for a country where Colin Kaepernick can do that.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I confronted this when I came back from war, and people were protesting the war at funerals of veterans, right?
I remember that.
And, you know, look, I didn't like that too much, right? Because that's like the family and their grief.
Yeah.
But I said, I went to war so they can do that.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
And you hear this issue, you know, people say, "Oh, burning the flag." And I said, "But that's a free society. That's a free society." Mm-hmm. Now, I don't think what Colin Kaepernick is doing is offensive. It doesn't offend me in the least bit.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's taking a knee to take a stand, and I think we're having an entire conversation in our country around incredibly valid issues, and they're only being raised at higher levels and addressed at higher levels because Colin Kaepernick and others were willing to endure the criticism and things that they went through. Mm-hmm. And our country has a long history of that. John Lewis got his skull fractured and beat in to drive a conversation about voting rights. And he paid a price for that. And now we lift that up and we hold that. But at the time, it was not viewed as such. And I think there will come a time in our country where we will universally, or not maybe not universally, but much higher, will look back at Colin Kaepernick being willing to sacrifice his own profession and his own standing and how he was seen in order to drive a broader conversation. And so I think what they're doing is very courageous. And I think they should be applauded for it. And I think that's why whether you agree, as I happen to agree with the validity of the points they're raising, or you disagree, which with some other protest I might disagree, I think that we can never lose sight of that fundamental principle of you have that right to peacefully protest, to make your voice heard, to criticize the actions of your government. And I don't think there's anything more patriotic that someone can do.
Well answered. And as we wrap it up here on the Educated Guest podcast, Nathan, are there any takeaways, anything that you want the listeners to just get from you?
Well, I would hope at the end, as we try and bring change to the county, I would hope folks would take away that our campaign is not, you know, I'm the candidate, but there's a broader effort that we're trying to do. And there's a direction that we're trying to go, and there's change that we're trying to bring. And we need help in that endeavor. And I am certainly far from perfect. I mean, none of us are. But I am very committed to trying to address these issues of equity, of trying to address these issues of a lot of the historic injustice, to trying to do everything we can. You know, you do what you can with what you have where you are to try and make the world a better place. And if we move this county, we're not going to single-handedly solve every problem that's out there. But boy, we can make a substantive impact. And so I would just encourage people, you know, as we head into the last 60 days of this campaign, if you like the way that all five Republican Board of Supervisors have been running the county for the last 30 years and don't support me, I support my opponent. But if you think they should do it a different way, then I would just ask for your help. For your vote, if you live in the district, for your dollars, $5, $10, you know, $2, it all, you know, the Marine Corps taught me ounces make pounds. You know, when you're building that pack, ounces make pounds, it all adds up. And if you have time to come volunteer with us, we phone bank out of our office here in Mission Valley every night. We're walking door to door. We're doing house parties because we're taking on a lot of opposition, and change is hard. You know, everybody likes progress. But progress doesn't come without change, and change has its enemies.
Oh yeah,
and it makes it difficult. And so folks can go to NathanFletcher.com and get lots of information and sign up to help us. And then we, you know, I hope to come back on here after we've been there for a little while and be able to talk about hopefully some of the progress we're making.
That's what's up, man. I appreciate you sharing not only what you believe in as a candidate, but just who you are as a person. That's what I wanted to capture. So I appreciate your time and your thoughts. November 6th, Nathan Fletcher for County Supervisor. Get out there and vote for this man. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Peace. I want to thank Nathan Fletcher for taking the time out of his busy, busy campaign. I want to thank his campaign manager, Heidi, for helping set up this interview. He's a special guy. He's got a wonderful beliefs, and I believe in him as a candidate. Otherwise, he wouldn't be on the podcast. Get out there and vote for this man and many other progressive candidates. Come November 6th, the Educated Kids podcast loves you. Coming from your man, ZRF, your man, Mr. _AYYY, and Ed Nunez. Peace out, y'all.